Benji Novak grew up in the lap of luxury thanks to his family's world-renowned Fontainebleau Hotel. But Benji had his own ambitions and would go on to create his own fortune with a successful event planning business.
He worked his ass off to make everything that he did a success.
Benji liked to party as hard as he worked, and that included dating strippers and hiring sex workers.
When he needed a girlfriend, he hired one.
But Benji's fate would quickly change when he met his future wife. Narcy was an ambitious woman who, according to the people closest to her, would stop at nothing to get what she wanted.
And she said, well, a woman has to do what a woman has to do to survive. And I go, Benji, you're in fucking trouble.
Hi, I'm Kareem Tapsch.
And I'm Joey Dowd. Balmy weather, beautiful beaches, and decadent nightlife may be what most people think of when they think Florida. But as Miami natives, we like to say that South Florida is a sunny place for shady people.
Every week we'll bring you a new story of a true crime case committed right here under the Florida sun. From the outrageous to the utterly bizarre. Think you've heard it all? Think again. This is Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami. It's 1964. Two men are playing cards by the pool. One is in the hole for $10,000. The other appears to be a stellar card player. That is, until a British secret agent uncovers his accomplice who's been using a telescope to read the other man's cards.
That's right, James Bond. This is one of the iconic scenes from the 1964 film Goldfinger, shot at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. And it wasn't an accident that Goldfinger was filmed there. Miami Beach was a hot location in the 60s. All the major stars performed along the hotels on Collins Avenue. Jackie Gleason, Ed Sullivan, Dean Martin, Harry Belafonte, Sammy Davis Jr., all were headliners. And the premier location was the Fontainebleau. Designed by Morris Lapidus, the Fontainebleau was built in 1954 by hotelier Ben Novak. Before Collins Avenue was filled with high-rise hotels and condos, it used to be a strip of private mansions. The Fontainebleau was built on the estate of Harvey Firestone from Firestone Tires.
The Fontainebleau was a place to see and be seen. It has the famous Stairway to Nowhere, where ladies can descend to make a grand entrance. When Frank Sinatra and Elvis, two of the biggest entertainers in the world, finally meet on stage, they do so at the Fontainebleau. That's how iconic the place was.
Modern hotelier Steve Wynn, who built most of the famous hotels in Las Vegas, commented that the Fontainebleau was the first to create the concept of the hotel as a show, according to the book The Prince of Paradise by John Glatt.
Despite being a successful businessman, Ben Novak wasn't above petty squabbles. In one famous story, his former business partner became his rival. Harry Muffson, who had worked with Novak for years, went on to build another famous hotel, the Eden Rock, right next door to the Fontainebleau. Novak wasn't going to be upstaged, so he builds an extension to the Fontainebleau, one that completely blocked out the Eden Rock's pool view. This extension became known as the Spite Wall.
Ben was married to Bernice Novak, and together they had a son named Ben Novak Jr. But to his friends, he was known as Benji.
Ben Sr. was a tough businessman, and Bernice held the glue to the society. It was, you know, one of the foremost hotels in Florida and world renowned. And Benji lived in the penthouse. He was an only child.
That's Charlie Serrader. He served on the Miami Beach Police Department for nearly 30 years. He was also friends with Benji, who spent his childhood growing up in the penthouse of the Fontainebleau.
I met him when he was about, I think, 14 years old. To say he was spoiled would be an understatement, but understanding how he grew up and the environment in which he grew up and having maids and housekeepers and just basically his life was in a hotel environment. So he had very few friends, and his staff were his best buddies.
He was kind of like the real-life Eloise, except instead of a young girl living at the Plaza in Manhattan, it's a young boy living at the Fontainebleau in Miami Beach.
Yeah, Charlie befriended Benji when he responded to police calls at the hotel.
He always hung out and had an admiration for the uniform officers who protected the property. And I got friendly with him back then.
Ben Sr. and Bernice would eventually separate. Bernice moved to Fort Lauderdale.
Things didn't improve for Ben Sr. He had to file for bankruptcy and sell the Fontainebleau. 8 years later, he died of a heart attack.
There was speculation as to who would take over the Fontainebleau, but the expectation was always that it would be Benji.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was a foregone conclusion, but he was an only child. And when his dad put the hotel into bankruptcy, it sort of left Benji on his own. There wasn't a settlement for several years after his dad's filing and then eventual death, and it was just him and his mom.
As an adult, Benji launched his own company called Convention Concepts Unlimited.
And then he started his business, Convention Concepts, and built an empire of his own doing, which he had learned all of it from experiencing the hotel industry hosting, big events.
It was an events production company that organized and ran conventions. His lifelong experience in the hospitality industry was prime training for running events in hotels. He also developed a reputation as a perfectionist for how he ran the business.
He just had that type A personality. He just demanded perfection from everybody and wanted to run the business like his daddy ran the business.
While he serviced a variety of businesses, Convention Concepts had one primary client, Amway. Amway is a multi-level marketing company that sells health, beauty, and home care products.
He would host as many as 4,000 to 6,000 guests at various hotels that he selected throughout the country. And he built his business by catering to the large-scale events for the hosting of these companies, everything from annual meetings to retreats. And he set up the hotels, he set up the airfare, he set up the food choices. That's what Convention Concepts was developed for, was to catering to the needs of those large multi-level marketing and large corporations who had a need for bringing all their employees to a centralized hosting meeting.
Benji would travel all over the country, running events for Amway and other clients.
He was a workaholic, and he worked his ass off to make everything that he did a success. And if he wanted something done, he had the resources and he had the funds to do it.
According to the Daily Beast, Convention Concepts was making $50 million a year. Obviously, this made Benji a lot of money, making him a millionaire. So Benji lived well. He had a nice house. But while lots of millionaires would usually spend their wealth buying fancy sport cars or boats, Benji had another hobby. Benji spent his millions on superhero memorabilia, specifically Batman. He became the largest private collector of Batman memorabilia. He even had a refurbished, fully operational Batmobile.
He built a small museum in his home on Las Olas to store all of the memorabilia. And then, of course, when you have a collector like Ben's personality, most people would consider it over the top. So its collections spilled out into the living spaces of his home, which would be on every surface.
It was so big, it filled four of the six warehouses on his property.
And it grew into a multi-million dollar collection.
His collection was valued at potentially being worth $15 million, according to the Daily Beast. Now, Batman wasn't the first thing Benji collected. According to Charlie, Benji first collected Coca-Cola memorabilia since his mom used to be a model for Coke. Then he collected first edition comic books before growing his Batman collection. I know what you're thinking. Batman's an interesting choice for a guy who grew up rich, catered to by housekeeping, and had an interest in police and crime fighting.
Whereas with Batman and the Batman and Robin series, it was a more of a living dream, if you will, to emulate, you know, the good guys against the bad guys, because eventually Benji did follow into police work as he got older and into his late teens. He would ride with me, you know, in a police car. And eventually he went through the Reserve Academy and got his own uniform. And then he would ride with me weekly, sometimes twice a week. And we did that for over 20 years. He wanted to be a policeman, but he knew he couldn't be a policeman because he developed his business and was building his business. So he got the best of both worlds by being able to work and do well at his company and then work for purposes of helping his community and satisfying whatever inner need that he had to wear a uniform and play policeman, which was very helpful to us because he was good with paperwork.
Benji also had another way he spent his downtime: strip clubs.
Well, Benji would go to strip clubs and dance clubs.
This is where he meets Narcisa Cira Veliz Pacheco, otherwise known as Narcy.
He met Narcy working at a strip club off of 36th Street in Hialeah.
Narcy was from Ecuador and had been dancing as a stripper under the name Sylvia.
He took a liking to her, and she figured he had money.
Did he usually date strippers, or was that...
Yeah, all bought and paid for. I mean, he worked so much that he was not capable of sustaining a normal relationship, if you will, by keeping a girlfriend. And so his M.O., was when he needed a girlfriend, he hired one.
Benji also paid for some physical modifications for Narcy.
She had her front end repaired, you know, and fixed. And the rumors were, of course, that, you know, she said she went in for a nose job and she came out with bigger boobs, which is all bullshit, you know. Benji's basically did that to many of his girlfriends, and he built the image of the woman that he wanted. Primarily, they were all girls or women with big tits, and if they didn't have them, he had them installed.
Charlie says although he'd seen Benji with a lot of different women, when it came to Narcy, he saw major red flags.
We were out in this 43-foot Hatteras, and he got a phone call from Narcy. And this is about 2 months after they initially met. And she was at his home, and she thought he was cheating on her. And she started threatening to burn his house down while he was out on the boat with us. And he's pleading with her, please, I'm just out here on a boat. We're road testing the boat. And we thought it was humorous, figuring that this woman's jealousy was so heightened at such an interesting part of their conversation, it just was laughable.
Benji had been a workaholic and never had a serious relationship. But then Benji announced he was getting married to Narcy. Initially, Charlie thought settling down and getting married might be good for Benji.
He was young, and it just seemed like he was really interested in getting married to her. And, you know, all his friends would, okay, Benji, if that's what you want to do, are you sure? And he, oh, yeah, I love her, you know, okay.
They got married in 1991, but Narcy did sign a prenup. If they split up, all she would get is $65,000. Now, it's important to state here that Narcy had a daughter from a previous marriage. Her name is May. According to Charlie, Benji adored May and would eventually legally adopt her. And as for Bernice, Benji's mom, she was not a fan of Narcy.
Simply put, his mother hated her. She wanted a nice Jewish girl for Benji. So initially, it was a very rough start from the wedding on with Bernice, and Bernice tolerated her. Didn't hate her, but tolerated her. And Narcy hated her. Didn't tolerate her.
Despite the tensions between Bernice and Narcy, they all worked for Benji's company, Convention Concepts. Even May would eventually work for the company once she was older.
May came to work for Convention Concepts, as did Narcy. And Bernice, his mother, came to work every single day until she was 86 years old. She was a workhorse. They would go and organize the hotel conventions that they would go at. They would handle the money. Ben set up all of the airfare. He set up all of the rooms, the food menus, the catering, the complaints. He ran the business like you would run the front end of a hotel, and he was excellent at it.
Now, unsurprisingly, given how their relationship started, they had a tumultuous marriage with fights and arguments. But that all came to a head on June 10th, 2002, when Benji was found gagged and tied to a chair, saying a group of men robbed him of over $1 million of money and items. He said he was beaten with a gun and they threatened to kill him. Charlie told us that Benji called him.
He said, "Charlie, I just got robbed." He goes, "I don't know what to do." I go, "What do you mean you got robbed?" He goes, "Guys busted in my house, and I think Narcy's involved." I said, "Well, what do you think that?" He goes, "When they came through the bedroom door, she yelled, 'Look out, he has a gun on his nightstand.'" I go, "Benji, you're in fucking trouble."
Benji was tied up for over 25 hours. Narcy's explanation to police, it was all part of a sex game. She admitted to planning the robbery, but Benji decided to not press charges. According to Charlie and some news reports, Narcy threatened to reveal Benji's porn fetishes, which was a collection of magazines of naked women with artificial limbs. But Charlie says that wasn't Benji's. It was a setup. According to Charlie, they negotiated a deal to pay Narcy $100,000 to get the stolen goods and money returned.
The bottom line was the negotiations included a cash settlement of her keeping $100,000 and giving them the rest of the cash.
Let's just reiterate what happened here. Benji's own wife had him tied up, beaten, and robbed. Then, instead of pressing charges, he pays her $100,000 in order to get his stolen money and items back.
I think if your wife sets you up for home invasion robbery, it's kind of difficult to go to the next step and have a happy marriage after that.
But that's exactly what Benji tried. Not only did he not press charges against Narcy, according to Charlie, he went to counseling and tried to reconcile the marriage.
It essentially changed my relationship with Ben, certainly to the extent that had anything to do with Narcy, because we told him, "You think this is over? This ain't over. If she's mad enough at you to set up a home invasion robbery, she's certainly mad enough to kill you."
Charlie was right. This was just the beginning for Narcy.
So it's 2002. Benji has just been tied up, beaten, and robbed by henchmen hired by his own wife, Narcy. Instead of pressing charges or even getting a divorce, they try to work their issues and stay married. Now, if you remember when Benji first started dating Narcy, she was suspicious of him cheating. Well, those fears weren't unfounded.
Now, was he also seeing people while he was married?
Of course. Like I said, Benji's relationships were pay-per-use. Most of the relationships that he kept, he tried to keep them private, but the people that I had gotten to work for Ben over the years, some of them for 20 years, were sort of his enablers and would go and run errands for him to take care of the women. And of course, Narcy wasn't stupid and was very jealous and suspected him.
One woman he got involved with was Rebecca Bliss, a porn actress and high-priced prostitute. They'd meet up and Ben would pay her $600 to have sex. He eventually set her up in a condo that he paid $1,400 a month for and bought $10,000 worth of music gear so she could learn to become a DJ, according to the Miami New Times.
In 2009, Narcy tracked down Rebecca and offered her $10,000 to stop seeing Benji. Rebecca refused. April 4th, 2009. Tragedy strikes. Bernice Novak, Benji's mother, is found dead in her house.
Well, it was on a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. I get a call from Benji. He says, I'm at my mom's house. I just found her dead in the kitchen alcove leading to the garage. There's blood all over the place. Can you get over here?
A trail of blood led from the car in the garage to the bathroom, where it was theorized she tried to clean herself up, back to the kitchen, then the laundry room, where she collapsed and died.
There was blood and blood splatter all over the house, but it was consistent with Bernice walking through the home from the garage and going into the living room, the dining room, and then the living room bathroom. There was blood everywhere, and it looked like she had just fallen a couple of times, and therefore the blood splatter was consistent with an elderly person falling.
Nothing was missing from the house, and there weren't any footprints in the blood. It was determined that she fell, hit her skull in the garage, then tried to get through the house before collapsing. Her death was ruled accidental.
About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, after the body was removed, we went to Jay Alexander's to grab a bite to eat and commiserate with Ben. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Narcy was stroking the back of his head, trying to comfort him. And that was my first inclination that something was wrong, because Narcy told me at the house that it was such a terrible thing, and then I was supposed to go shopping with Bernice this morning. And I was like, I don't know who you're talking to, but why would you go shopping with Bernice? I didn't say a word. I kept my mouth shut. And that was sort of like the first hair on the back of my head that went up, that something wasn't right.
Charlie wasn't the only one that had suspicions about Bernice's death. Something didn't feel right to Benji.
There are just some things that stood out to Ben, and he questioned it from day one, that this was not a natural death of his mom.
Despite his suspicions that something didn't make sense about his mother's death, Benji would unfortunately never get to investigate further. Just 3 months after his mom's death, Benji Novak would also be found dead.
It's July 12th, 2009. Benji Novak is in Rybrook, New York, running an event for Convention Concepts at a Hilton hotel. It's a big event for Amway with over 1,000 attendees. Narcy and May are also with him.
They were in their last days of convention activities. And at 7:15 to 7:40 in the morning, I get a phone call from May. And she tells me that Ben was found dead in the hotel room. And I was shocked, to say the least, and disheartened.
Benji had been alone in the room. It was normal for Benji to work late into the night preparing for the next day, while Narcy got up early to get everything ready. She had already left the room to prepare. When she returned to the room, she found Benji face down on the floor, covered in blood. He was beaten and tortured. His face, hands, and legs were tied with duct tape. Reporter Tara Rosenblum from News 12 in New York said his eyes were slit out like grapes. She called it a grotesque murder scene.
And when I found out the manner of death and that his eyes were cut, I knew that it was a revenge murder.
The violent nature of the murder and the fact that nothing had been stolen from the room, not even his Rolex, led investigators to believe this was personal. Narcy was taken in for questioning.
She said she left the room around 7:15 a.m. and said bye to Benji, who was still awake. She said Benji scolded her for not giving him a besito, Spanish for a kiss. Narcy was seen on security cameras leaving the room. When she came back to the room, she said she tripped on something on the floor and then realized it was Benji's body. She said, quote, only a monster can do this kind of evil thing, end quote. She hypothesized this could have been a robbery gone wrong, but again, nothing was missing.
Despite denying having anything to do with the murder, she became a person of interest pretty quickly. For one, she did a polygraph and failed.
Now, we should point out that polygraph machines, also known as lie detector machines, are unreliable and generally inadmissible in court. But still, to law enforcement, this is a red flag.
May called and said that her mother failed the polygraph and that her mother was starting to accuse her of being involved. So talk about deflection.
But there was a more glaring piece of evidence. There was no sign of forced entry. Whoever did this was able to get inside because Benji let them in, or they had a key card. When police looked at the entry records of the door, no one else had accessed it except Narcy. Police started to believe she might have let the killers into the room herself. But despite these suspicions, there wasn't enough evidence to charge Narcy.
3 days after Benji's murder, May flew back home to South Florida. She went by Benji's house to pick up some items before going home.
I got a frantic phone call from May saying that she had already arrived and she was at home and her mother is there. And what is her mother doing out of New York? They were following her, drove over to the house, and as I pull up in the driveway, May comes running out, Narcy behind her with a crowbar in her hands, and she starts swinging it at May.
That's right. Narcy was swinging a crowbar at her own daughter. According to Charlie, he was able to defuse the situation and grab the crowbar. Not only was Narcy threatening May, according to a police report, she had also hired a security guard to keep May from getting into the house.
They were accusing each other of killing Ben. So I went into the house and I sat at the kitchen table and talked to Narcy. And I told her, Narcy, you know, your husband's dead. His mother is dead. You're a prime suspect. And you're supposed to be in New York, and now you wind up here. What are you doing? And she said, well, a woman has to do what a woman has to do to survive. And I go, well, murdering her husband ain't one of them. After my conversation, I knew that she was directly involved in it.
Police searched the house and seized paperwork, computers, Benji's day planner, and 5 rolls of duct tape.
A week after the murder, police would get a mysterious clue when they received an anonymous letter in Spanish saying that Narcy and an unnamed accomplice were behind the murder of Benji in order to get his millions. Not only that, but Benji's mom, Bernice, didn't trip and fall. She was also murdered as part of this scheme. This reopened the case in Fort Lauderdale, which had been closed and deemed an accidental death.
The investigation would continue, slowly. Benji's body remained at the medical examiner's office for nearly 2 months, which raised suspicion with police on why Narcy would let her husband's body remain there, according to CBS News. He was finally buried in his family's mausoleum in Queens. Another break came in August, when police went to Cristobal Velisa's apartment, Narcy's brother. On his table, they saw a Western Union wire transfer of $500. They suspected this might be a payment to a hitman. Police tracked down the person who received the payment, a man named Alejandro Garcia, and brought him in for questioning. Garcia immediately became a person of interest. After reviewing surveillance footage, police were actually able to place him inside the hotel at the time Benji was killed.
During the interview, he denied. They finally showed him the video. He then copped out to the murder, copped out to Bernice's murder. He was involved in that.
Garcia was recruited by Veliz, Narcy's brother, along with another guy, Melvin Medrano, to attack Bernice. Garcia and Medrano staked out Bernice's house. When she got home and parked her car in the garage, Garcia snuck around and beat her with a wrench after she got out of the car.
She was moving her car from the driveway into the garage, and as she went to get out of the garage, they hit her with a monkey wrench on the side of her head, breaking her jaw and knocking out some teeth. And they left her for dead. They didn't know that she didn't die. That's the reason why she kept falling going into the house, not only from a loss of blood, but from being smacked in the head with a monkey wrench. Yeah, and then she walked through the kitchen, she walked through the dining room, through the living room, tried to wipe all the blood off of her in the bathroom, sat on the toilet, wiping her face, blood all over the towels. So it, you know that it was her that was doing it, but didn't have the wherewithal to get on a phone and call 911 or something. And that was typical of Bernice. Self-sufficient, and probably thought it wasn't as bad as it was.
In addition to the details behind Benji's murder, which we'll get to in a second, Garcia had one more shocking piece of information to reveal.
As a surprise, mentioned that he still had one more that he was going to be paid for. And when they inquired what it was, after a couple of hours, he opened up his wallet and showed him a picture of May as the next intended target that Narcy was going to have her daughter killed.
Wait a minute. She was going to have her own daughter killed?
Yeah, according to Charlie, Narcy felt May knew she had Benji killed and didn't want her around to talk to the police. As for Benji's murder, four men were involved. Narcy's brother and the three hitmen he hired. Alejandro Garcia, Joel Gonzalez, and Dennis Ramirez. On July 12th, 2009, the four of them waited at a gas station. Narcy leaves the hotel room. Charlie said she did try to have an alibi because she put herself in front of a surveillance camera when she made a phone call.
You see her on the video, clearly standing in the hallway, pulling a little luggage piece, and she's standing in front of the camera. She put some thought into that part of it, you know.
At 6:39 a.m., Narcy calls her brother, Elise, who then tells Ramirez to drop Garcia and Gonzalez off at the hotel. Just before 7 a.m., Narcy lets Garcia and Gonzalez into the room with Benji. They beat him with dumbbells, bound his arms and legs with duct tape, and cover his mouth. According to Charlie, Garcia said Narcy was there for the attack.
They bind him up, tie him up, beat the shit out of him with the 2-pound barbells that they had bought at Walmart. And then he suffocates and dies and be asphyxiated on his own vomit. And as a parting shot, she instructs them to cut their eyes out with a utility knife.
After the murder, Charlie says Narcy went back to the convention to have breakfast and act like everything was normal. Then she went back to the room where she discovered her murdered husband.
And then feigned the wife coming up to the hotel room, finding her husband dead. And the odd thing about it is she refused to admit to the responders that he was dead. It was, who would hurt my husband? Get him to the hospital. And clearly he expired.
So the big question, what was the grand plan? Why go through all of this? And why murder Bernice, Ben's mom?
Now, obviously, they had a complicated and volatile marriage. Narcy was a jealous woman, and Benji continually slept with strippers and prostitutes, and Narcy knew this. But remember, Narcy signed a prenup when they first got married. If she divorced Benji, all she would get was $65,000.
And Ben threw that out to her a number of times, you know, when they had their issues. And she built up this resentment and hatred. Her master plan was to have the mother killed, and then everything would fall to Ben.
With Bernice dead, Benji would inherit everything, on top of the millions he already had. Bernice's estate was valued at around $2 million at the time of her death. Then, with Benji having inherited everything, she'd have him killed so she would inherit all his wealth.
Narcy saw that as an opportunity to set up the murder of Ben Novak Jr. and become the sole heir of everything that both of them owned, using her brother as a cover for the middleman to make sure that no funds transferred directly from her to the bad guys.
Basically, divorce Benji and get no money, or kill Benji and inherit everything. Looking at the paper trail, the day after Benji's murder, Narcy took more than $100,000 of proceeds from the convention and deposited it into her and Benji's personal account. She used this to pay attorney's fees and the hitmen.
After Ben's death, when Narcy came back, she convinced the bank people to let her in to the bank box, even though her name wasn't on the box. She kept telling them that Ben was out in the car, he'll be in a minute. Anyway, they let her in, and of course she cleaned out the box, and no one really knows what was in there, because Ben and his mother would have been the last people to have got in there.
Narcy started liquidating everything. She sold most of Benji's Batman collection. That confrontation at the house with May, Narcy was trying to get everything she could out of the home.
And a lot of stuff was liquidated. When Ben was rebuilding his house, I had two safes installed that Narcy was not aware of, but through taking the house apart and talking to the employees that put it there, she found them. One was in a safe at the base of the door inside his Bat Museum, and the other one was hidden in a step going up to the second floor, hidden underneath a step. And they were concreted in, and she had them drilled out. So, smart cookie, she figured it all out.
But as smart as she was at finding the secret safes, it wasn't enough for her and her brother to get away with murder.
And to keep things even more in the family, remember the anonymous letter that basically ratted out Narcy? Turns out that letter was written by Leticia Toruno, who, in an unexpected twist, is Narcy and Velisa's own sister. In December of 2012, Narcy Novak and Cristobal Veliz were both sentenced to life in prison. Narcy refused to be in the courtroom when the verdict or sentence were given. The judge said her refusal to be in court was, like the killings, evidence she was a coward. U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara said, quote, Narcy Novak and her brother Cristobal Veliz have blood on their hands and unspeakable acts of violence to their names. And they'll spend the rest of their lives in prison answering for what they did in the name of money, end quote. Now, as for the actual hitmen who carried out the murders, Alejandro Garcia got 17 years and Joel Gonzalez got 10 years.
I didn't agree with the term of sentences that the actual murderers received, but that was a plea deal based on their cooperation and testimony against Narcy and her brother. And yeah, at the end of the day, the people who were responsible for the murder were held accountable. My feeling is that Ben knew what he was doing. Unfortunately, Narcy knew what she was doing as well. She thought she was smarter than everybody else. And this guy was tortured and had a death that I wouldn't wish upon my worst enemy. At the end of the day, the kid lived a good life until he was murdered, and that his wife deserves to spend the rest of her life in prison, and the brother right there with her.
Despite the brutal and untimely death of its one-time heir, today the Fountain Blue Hotel remains one of the most prominent resort destinations in the southeastern United States. In 2008, it was added to the National Register of Historic Places. That same year, it also underwent a billion-dollar renovation that breathed new life into the property. It retains many of the iconic designs of its storied past, and today hosts some of the most popular restaurants and nightclubs in America.
Thank you for listening to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami, where each new episode will bring you a true crime story right from the South Florida headlines.
Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami is a production of Sonoro and Trojan Horse in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura Network. Hosted and produced by Kareem Tapsch, Joey Dowd, and Christian Hatar. Edited by Angelina Mosher Salazar. Fact-checking by Evelyn Uribe and Sara Mota. Engineering by Mane Parra, Daniel Padilla, and Fernando Galaviz. Executive produced by Jasmine Romero and Joshua Weinstein for Sonoro, Kareem Tapsch and Alex Fumero for Trojan Horse, and Giselle Bansis and Conal Byrne for iHeart. Listen to Paradise Lost, Crime in Miami on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.